Welcome to episode 3 of the RRM podcast, where we discuss restorative reproductive medicine with Reply Fertility. I'm Deborah Colleton, your host. Today we're talking about RRM treatment for infertility, and we're joined by Dr. Kim Barrows, a board-certified family medicine physician from Michigan, and Dr. Kyle Beiter, board-certified OBGYN from Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deborah.
What is the definition of infertility? If someone's having a fertility challenge, they're not getting pregnant when they want to, how do you medically define when someone is suffering from infertility or what is sometimes called subfertility? Dr. Barrows, can you share with us just so that listeners know what the definition is?
Sure. Yeah. So infertility is defined as 1 year of regular unprotected intercourse without conceiving a pregnancy.
1 year. And isn't that sometimes a shorter time frame considered if someone is either of a certain age or if they're actually having focused intercourse?
Yeah, that's a good point. At times, if someone is actually regularly tracking their cycles, especially with one of the scientifically validated methods of tracking your cycles, one of the fertility awareness-based methods, then 6 months would be an adequate time for regular unprotected sexual intercourse, not conceiving a pregnancy. That would signal a problem and something that you should have checked out.
So most people have heard of IVF as a solution for infertility. I'm guessing most have not heard of RRM. Dr. Beiter, could you just tell us an overview? What is the difference between IVF and RRM as an approach to treating infertility?
Sure. Well, IVF, you know, that approach investigated back in the 70s, and by the late 70s is when the first IVF treatment cycles were performed. But basically, the underlying attitude behind IVF is we're going to cancel out hormonally a woman's cycle. We're going to rebuild it from scratch with a lot of hormonal injections, and we're going to get the raw products. We're going to obtain the egg, obtain the sperm, put them together in a test tube, and inject it or transfer it into the woman's uterus. So it's a very kind of mechanistic approach to infertility. And I think that some of the issue behind it, and again, I don't want to cast aspersion on, you know, all mainstream fertility doctors, that they just want to help patients. Okay, I get that. I disagree with how they do it. And I think women are much better served with RRM. But I think part of the underlying attitude that fosters that, well, there's a number of areas. One is their black and white binary approach to diagnosing underlying problems. For example, they say, okay, is your progesterone level 3 at least? Yeah. Okay. Well, unless that's not a problem. Then is your sperm count at least 15 million? Okay. Then that's not a problem. Are you having your menses each month? Oh, okay. Well, yes. Then you're ovulating. That's not a problem. In reality, those limits they set are the bare minimum functional assessment. So really, for example, in sperm count, 15 million. Well, that's the WHO 95th lower percentile. So to be satisfied with that and say, hey, well, as long as you're doing at least the fifth percentile of what men do, then we're not going to worry about that. I really don't think that's a good attitude. I mean, the average fertility couple, the average couple that is fertile, has about a 60 to 70 million sperm count, for example. So shouldn't we be aiming more for the quality of what's going on here rather than some minimum bare bones threshold and be happy with that? If those minimum bare bone thresholds fail, well, no, it's unexplained. We just have to do IVF now. I kind of think that's their overall strategy in a nutshell.
Dr. Barrows, talk about unexplained infertility. Yeah, I often hear from RRM clinicians, not that there's never unexplained, but it's very rare to have something truly unexplained when it comes to infertility. Have you ever had a patient with unexplained infertility?
Well, I would say not really. No, when we have unexplained infertility, which I frequently hear from patients that have come to me from previous doctors, maybe it's an IVF clinic, maybe it's their OBGYN or their family doctor. Usually I say, well, did they check this? Did they check this? Did they check this? And most of the time they're like, no, I don't think so. Or they're like, we got a full hormonal panel, and I'll look and see what was that full hormonal panel in the old records. And it's very small compared to what we would do. And it's not timed with the cycle appropriately. We know that only 13% of cycles when you're ovulating, the textbook says you'll ovulate around day 14, but only 13% of the time does that actually happen, because women are all different and each cycle is different. So if you're just guessing that 14 is when you're going to ovulate, so a week later, 21 is when you get your lab work, that's going to be very inadequate for most of the time, 87%. Also, I definitely tell people we don't stop at the first diagnosis we find. We may find probably on the average 3 to 6 diagnoses that we're going to see that affect your fertility. And not one of them is going to necessarily be the silver bullet that we just fix that one thing and now you're good. I would definitely say keep searching. If someone tells you you don't have a certain diagnosis, but you suspect you have, do get a second opinion, because a lot of times they just didn't dig far enough. And that's a real disservice to women, because it does kind of give you that reassurance that, well, they said they did a pelvic exam and it was normal. The ultrasound was normal. So I don't have PCOS. I can't have endometriosis, they told me. And oftentimes that's really false assurance. And we find that, yes, you do, even sometimes after a surgery is done by a surgeon who's not really an expert in looking for the subtle signs of endometriosis.
Now, one of the really encouraging things I think about RRM is when you hear from patients who are excited that their health is improving through this process. Definitely, if you're going to become parents, it's good to have your health optimized. And of course, it's good for anyone to have their health optimized. But I often point that out. That's another big differentiator, that if you go through IVF and you don't wind up having a baby, you've gained essentially nothing. And when you go through restorative reproductive medicine, almost every patient has their health improved. So you gain the knowledge of why this is happening to you. And that's something that I would love to see studied. It hasn't really been studied yet. Like, what is just the psychological benefit of understanding why this is happening? And then obviously to have any health improvement is, again, such a differentiator that the entire ethos of restorative reproductive medicine is we have to improve reproductive function. That's how you get a baby with RRM. Yeah, that has to happen through natural intercourse. So,
and first, you're feeling better.
Compared to the scene in Apollo 13 where they're stuck out in space and they have to get back to Earth with the materials that they have in the lamb. So with RRM, you have the male body and the female body, and that's what you're working with, and you have to make it work. And it's interesting. I wonder how much we've lost over the decades because so much of modern reproductive medicine relies on assisted reproductive technology like IVF for solutions. So it's almost like you've turned your brains off in the direction of how do we make this happen with the tools we have? And the tools in this case are the male and female bodies whose organs were designed, the only organs designed to work cooperatively with another human being, right?
Yeah, the tools that we can give people to use with their natural cycles, their bodies, we can give them tools to improve their health, and they actually do feel better. That's what's amazing. I even can think of a patient that was told her only hope was to do IVF, and not only with her, she didn't have, they said, enough eggs for her to make a baby, so they told her it needed to be a donor egg. And then within a few months of feeling better, her treatment course back on track of her health instead of the painful treatments and stressful treatments that she'd been going through with IVF and failing. She actually conceived with her own egg and has had a healthy baby and is working on baby number 2 now. So
that's so exciting. And what is the scale of the problem of infertility in the United States?
The scale is pretty huge. From the most recent statistics at the CDC, they said 1 out of 5 couples are struggling with infertility, and that 1 out of 4 are having trouble or having miscarriages. And worldwide, from the World Health Organization, they said it was 1 out of 6. So it seems like it may even be a little worse here in the United States than it is worldwide.
Well, we'll want to unpack that. That's an interesting feature. Dr. Biter, we hear sort of the conventional descriptor of the problem of infertility tells us that it's generally 1/3 attributable to female factors, 1/3 to male, and 1/3 to a combination of male and female. Is that what the data tell us? Is that accurate in your experience? You've been treating infertility couples for decades now.
Yes, that's an interesting topic to talk about. First of all, when we approach a couple, of course, we never point fingers and cast blame. Well, you're the problem, or she's the problem, he's the problem. Okay, so first of all, we don't approach it like that. Second of all, yeah, you'll find a number of studies throughout the years that have tried to come up with proportions of causes for infertility, male factor, female factor, both. I mean, some break it down into endometriosis, fallopian tubes, sperm count, endometriosis. But the frustrating thing with those studies is how, let's say a woman has endometriosis, how do we know that that is the problem? We often know that, at least in RRM, when we evaluate couples, we find a handful or more of problems that the couple has between them. Sometimes it can be clear, perhaps, what seems like the leading problem in that. Like, gosh, maybe she has really strong imaging evidence of endometriosis, severe pain, and so forth, that might lead one to think that endometriosis may be the main problem. And it could be. But oftentimes, you have a mix of problems, and it might not be clear what the leading problem is. So I have no problem with generalizations. Okay, one-third male, one-third female, one-third unexplained. Okay, that's fine to generalize just for studies. But I think as time goes on, it'd certainly be nice to know what is a bigger problem, your vitamin D level or your endometriosis or your endometrial polyp. I mean, it'd be really nice to be able to stratify that.
So this is really interesting. You're actually touching on something that, in my experience, has been a distinguishing hallmark of restorative reproductive medicine, which is that it's often multi-factor. So
for sure.
I know in my personal case, when I struggled with infertility and was found to have a thyroid disorder, we sort of got all excited, like, oh, we finally found out what's wrong, and just assumed that we had the answer. And I didn't know for actually still years more that there were bigger, worse factors contributing to the problem. So talk about that a little bit. Like, how much of a differentiator is that with restorative reproductive medicine? That since we know it's multi-factor, how do you sort of do that dance of, let's look for all 100 plus possible causes and contributors? You know, you don't want to exhaust every couple out and subject them to every possible thing you could do. On the other hand, you don't want to leave important stones unturned. My question is, how big a differentiator is that with restorative reproductive medicine compared to what a patient might get in a conventional evaluation?
I guess I would say, starting out, that certainly we have I'm sure Dr. Barrows would echo this, but I think we start out with a broad mindset, knowing that, you know, no one has infinite time, money, resources. So I think you start with the reasonable, more common things, but there are a lot of potential things to rule out. I think the theme is, you discover a number of things, you have those addressed, and if someone has success, okay, great, they conceived, great, we got our goal. But the more you find, you correct it all, they're still not conceiving, then you can go more towards maybe second tier things that aren't as common. Gosh, could you go to more of the autoimmune things and look into that? Could you go to things like post-coital testing? You know, these are things that don't have as much study behind them, but still things that you could look into if, you know, the first level investigations haven't got you success.
So I know at Reply, there are different categories of, you look at anatomical possible factors, infectious, ovulatory, as you mentioned, autoimmune, metabolic, hormonal, lifestyle factors. What are some of the sort of most common classic underlying conditions that you find for couples facing infertility?
Certainly, you mentioned a lot of the categories, certainly hormonal, progesterone secretion, for example, thyroid, for example, ovulatory problems, structural, gosh, endometriosis, fibroids, endometrial polyps, congenital uterine anomalies. There are a lot of things that your initial workup can point you, you know, in that direction.
Of the things that you find, roughly speaking, what percentage are treatable? Which, of course, treatment doesn't guarantee that you'll have a baby, but treatment should guarantee that you are going to be able to improve your reproductive function to increase your chance of having a baby. How often do you find something where you just say, there's really nothing we can do to restore reproductive function? So conversely, how often do you find something that's treatable?
The vast majority of things we test for, we do so because we can treat it. Really, the only two groups of patients we know we can't help is if a woman's fallopian tubes are irreparably damaged or absent. That's one example. Second example is for the man. If he has uncorrectable azoospermia, no sperm at all, and completely uncorrectable. And thankfully, the proportion of couples that fall into those categories are very low. Just off the top of my head, maybe 1% or less. So I don't know if Dr. Barrows wants to add to that, but that's what I would say.
Dr. Barrows, in your experience, what do you frequently find?
In my experience, that's very unlikely to find something that isn't treatable. I think I've only had one or two couples that I could say, there's not much we can do for this situation. Most of the time, It is a lot of PCOS and endometriosis, like Dr. Bider mentioned. I know he wanted to talk about endometriosis specifically, and I do too, because I think it's so important that so many women are underdiagnosed. I mean, 1 out of 9 women have that, so it's very common. I also see a lot of ovulatory dysfunction. Metabolic health is huge, and metabolic dysfunction for both men and women is very contributory towards subfertility. I like to call it subfertility because absolute infertility is very, very rare, like we were just talking about. So there is hope, and they improve health even if the unusual circumstances actually that they don't conceive a baby after some time of working through these things. But even without conceiving a baby, your health is generally very much improved.
Question for either of you, are there serious underlying factors that a patient urgently would need to know, or that you would need to know as a treating clinician? Meaning, are there things that can manifest in infertility for female or male that conceivably could be life-threatening? So in other words, we really need to find out what is causing this.
I would say that on the one hand, thankfully, most of the conditions we uncover are chronic things like insulin resistance or obesity or poor lifestyle. I mean, that can lead to serious problems down the road. Yes, cardiovascular disease, stroke, and so forth. So it's not immediately life-threatening, but it certainly should be addressed and deserves to be addressed, and a fertility factor and a broader than that, just a whole person perspective. Now, things that are immediately life-threatening, thankfully, at least in my experience, are more rare. I have a couple examples in mind. One I had was one of the husbands of one of the couples I worked with, and his prolactin was off. So had him get a brain MRI, and he did have quite a large pituitary tumor that ended up needing surgery. So he did have surgery, and then later on, they were able to conceive. That's one example. A second example, a patient of mine with recurrent miscarriages that kept having headaches and actually had a seizure. And so she had an MRI. She had a tumor as well, a brain tumor. So now, again, I don't want to say that brain tumors are a huge cause of infertility. Okay, they're not. Certainly, they can impact some of the hormones in the brain and the way the brain communicates with the ovaries and testes. But I guess my point is, I think that acute, serious things are relatively uncommon, whereas the chronic issues are much more common.
It does show how your reproductive health at some level is a reflection of your overall health.
Yeah, another example is men with, an issue, erectile dysfunction in men. That certainly has to do with vascular blood flow. And if you have a problem there, I know urologists many times are keen to make sure, hey, let's look at your heart. Do you have any heart issues or any circulation problems in other places in your body? So that's always something we think about as well.
And Dr. Barrows, tell us about the fairly unique feature with restorative reproductive medicine where you partner with patients, and in particular with female patients who are tracking their cycle, both in the evaluation phase where a woman tracking biomarkers of her cycle are able to report things with real medical value to help with that evaluation. And then later on during treatment, you can see improvements in reproductive health that are reflected through tracking of those biomarkers. Can you give us just an overview of how it always strikes me as just so, frankly, astonishing that this incredible health tool and all of this data is just not used in conventional medicine? It truly is a vital sign that's easily trackable, has great medical meaning, and is helpful for other health purposes and health monitoring. So tell us, how burdensome is it for women to track their cycles in a medically meaningful way? How often do you as a clinician dip into that data? How helpful do you find it? Just give us that whole story from a clinician perspective.
Sure. Yeah. I find it very helpful when someone's tracking their cycles, especially when they have one of the methods that is taught by a certified teacher. I think that's really key, that sometimes we just want to do the easy thing, and I get it too. It's really easy to just download a free app and start tracking, which isn't a bad thing to do, but it's not going to give you the kind of information that you really want. And for your health and for your overall health, as well as reproductive health, you really want the best. Taking the time to learn with a teacher is so valuable. I also get a lot of great information from those teachers, because a lot of times the teachers will be able to identify something that the patient hasn't noticed, doesn't realize is a problem, and they'll be able to give me a heads up before I even see the patient. So I know what I should be looking for too. And it helps with the exam. It helps the history go better. And then when we're continuing to see improvement in the cycles, they'll be working together with that teacher, seeing improvement with the teacher and talking with me. One of the things that I think women don't understand is how their luteal phase should be very stable in length of days. Each woman has her own length. That is kind of what her actual length should be. It can be different from one woman to the next, but you shouldn't have a lot of variation between.
Just to clarify for people who might not know what the luteal phase is.
The time after ovulation. So for the time from ovulation until we menstruate is the time that we call the luteal phase. And then before we ovulate, we call that the follicular phase. That can be more variable. And that has a lot to do with stressors. It has to do with sleep. It has to do with whether you were sick that month. Things like that can either delay ovulation a little bit or they can make it happen earlier. And that's very common, not necessarily abnormal. But if the luteal phase after ovulation is significantly short or variable length, then that's something that the RRM trained clinician will be really astute about and will start treating you for that.
So we'll need to have you back for an entire episode or multiple episodes on the full understanding of the cycle. So that will be great. I'd love to hear from each of you, what is patient reaction to restorative reproductive medicine? When you encounter a new patient who has not been exposed to this type of care, what do you hear from your patients, in particular, your patients facing infertility?
At first, they're shocked that I can look at their chart that they've been maybe working on for like 2 months with the teacher, the fertility awareness-based method, where they've charted their cycles, and I can tell them some things about their cycle and what I suspect might be going on with their hormones, which they're very amazed because most of the time when a doctor looks at that chart, they may not even look at it, but a lot of times they're not educated about it, so they don't really know what to say. I think that's one thing. They're really amazed and they really appreciate that we notice different patterns in the chart, details in the chart that would be otherwise overlooked or ignored. And then when we do a deep dive and kind of dig into all those underlying factors over and over again, I just hear, I wish all medical appointments could be like this, where you're actually looking for the underlying causes. Because like we mentioned endometriosis, we know that there are women out there that have endometriosis that have conceived and haven't even had maybe much trouble with conception or with miscarriages, and they don't have a delay, but it's found perhaps on a C-section. When the C-section is done, they see, oh, there is some endometriosis in there, and yet she has no idea. She didn't have the pain. She didn't have the delay in conception. So there's lots of things that you have to keep looking sometimes. You can't just stop, like with the first thing, like you mentioned, Deborah, with the thyroid, that must be it.
Dr. Bider, what has been your experience?
I think they feel validated. I mean, a lot of them are frustrated because they don't have any answers or reasons. Maybe they felt like, their other provider said, hey, well, let's do IVF. And the patient said, well, I don't want to do that. And then they said, well, okay, we're done. So I think they feel very frustrated. And sometimes they may suspect things and weren't given a chance to maybe do some investigation. Of course, focusing on surgery for many years. One example at the top of my head, a 39-year-old, and she didn't have much in the way of pelvic pain, but had been trying to conceive for a long time. So did a laparoscopy and removed endometriosis from her fallopian tube, and she conceived the next month. And that was a pretty dramatic, quick example, but she had a full-term good delivery. And, so I think she felt validated that I knew that, it's not for lack of desire on the patient's part. They want to get pregnant and they're doing all they can. They think, man, I just think there's something here holding me back. And I just want to try to find it out and want to find physicians and healthcare professionals who help me do this. And I think we try to fill that role in RRM.
Now, you're both trained in multiple methods of restorative reproductive medicine. What have your interactions been with professional medical colleagues as far as interest in restorative reproductive medicine?
Oftentimes it's easier to speak to medical students and residents than it is maybe to attendings or healthcare professionals that have been practicing for many, many years and kind of more set in their ways. I think that's true about many things, but I think that, for example, medical residents, medical students are often very interested when they hear about this and want to be involved in it. And they haven't been kind of ingrained by the medical system that, hey, IVF is the only thing out there. It's the best. Oh, look at all this technology. It's the best. They don't have that ingrained yet. I think for some providers, that can be difficult to overcome sometimes. I think that when other physicians, though, start to see results, I think they become more interested. So I guess that's been my experience.
I would say the same. Sometimes the seasoned professional, you know, us included, we kind of think we know what we're doing. We've got our toolbox. And if there's a tool out there that we haven't even heard of and we're the expert, it's pretty hard to accept that. Does this really work? But I think when they see the results, so I've definitely seen even in allied health professionals with the ultrasound techs that were seeing my patients coming in to track their follicles. And then they were seeing, wow, these patients are getting pregnant, the ones that are doing the restorative reproductive program. And so that was very helpful that then ultrasound techs were referring patients to me for that reason. Or when you're sending them to someone who's going to be their delivering physician, I had one that had, unfortunately, 12 miscarriages, and she was already in her later reproductive years, almost at the end of her reproductive lifespan as far as when she could have a baby. She had some chronic medical problems. She saw us on a last-ditch effort on her 13th pregnancy, and we were able to help her have that baby. And I think that the whole OB department was pretty amazed because I'm sure they had seen her come in many, many times with sad story of miscarriage after miscarriage.
That's interesting. We definitely have had some reply patients with a similar story pattern. I think the oldest patient who's conceived naturally at reply is 50, if it's 51 or 52. Now, I'll ask you this. I hear RRM clinicians over the last few years have said 43 is the new 35. And obviously, age is a factor when it comes to fertility challenges. What is your view of age, in particular for the female? If a woman is still cycling regularly, up to what age do you feel like you have a really reasonable shot at helping address underlying factors? Or is it just so different with everyone that that's too hard to answer?
I mean, I think there's certainly some themes that we could talk about. I mean, studies of maximum human fertility, a lot of the studies that I'm familiar with are mostly done in groups like the Amish or Hutterites or Mennonites, you know, farming communities. They never use contraception. They try to have as many children as they can to help work on the farm, for example. And they have, even in the early 40s, pregnancy rates, you know, 25, 30%, declining, of course. Their situation is perhaps different from someone who has never tried to conceive or never conceived, who is 42 or 43, for example. I'm loath to cut someone off entirely in their early 40s, for example, because sometimes, hey, is charting, for example, progesterone supplementation, for example, or thyroid support, is that very dangerous, very expensive, very burdensome for patients? No. So simple things like that, I think almost at any age, and you could argue that might be good for your general health as well, to track your cycle, make sure it's fine. Treating your cycle might have other benefits like PMS or some other things. Maintaining your thyroid very well, maintaining your metabolic health, that's good for anyone any age and can probably increase your fertility. Now, would I shy away from maybe more invasive treatments at someone at the upper end of the spectrum? Yes. Okay. For example, if she has no pain at all and no imaging signs of endometriosis, would I counsel someone 44 years old to have a laparoscopy for fertility alone? Well, probably not. And the reason is because, yeah, while that may help her fertility, that incremental increase at her age is much, much less than someone who's 31, for example. So I think you do have to customize it somewhat.
Fascinating. Well, I want to thank you both so much for all of this information. Any listeners who would like to learn more could go to replyfertility.com, where you can learn more about infertility. You can learn more about Dr. Kimberly Barrows and Dr. Kyle Biter. They are now seeing patients in close to half the country. Reply's goal is to try to reach throughout the United States and make services available by the end of this year or early 2026. Thank you again so much. And we look forward to hearing from both of you further on many topics related to restorative reproductive medicine and the new fertility paradigm.
To ask questions about RRM or to learn more about restorative reproductive medicine, you can contact us at replyfertility.com/podcast. Keep up to date about RRM by following us on your favorite podcast or social platform. All the links are in the show notes. Thank you for listening to the RRM podcast, and we'll see you next time.